Thank you. Our second speaker is Dr. Sundoz Kelis, Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics, also Department of Statistics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Kelis will be speaking about integrative models of genetic and epigenomic data.
Okay, thank you, Trent. And I want to start by thanking both Debashish and Trent for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I'm going to be mainly talking about integrating genome-wide association studies with the large amounts of functional annotation data that we have been getting through these large consortia projects. Yuan talked about TCGA. I'll throw in a couple of other names in there and then hopefully illustrate how you can put all of these together. So when we talk about genome-wide association studies, probably most of us are familiar with it, but just to set the stage, these studies start with cases and controls, diseased, healthy, sequence everybody, and then try to identify positions in the genome that differ between the two phenotypes so that you can explain the variation you are seeing in phenotype. So we can criticize genome-wide association studies, but we also have to agree that they have been successful to a certain extent. There are a couple of major shortcomings of current state of the art for GWAS. One of them is the issue of low power, and that's not going to go away very quickly because some diseases, complex diseases, are just very heterogeneous. So especially, for example, if you look at psychiatric diseases, in all of these examples, attention deficit disorder, bipolar, major depressive disease and schizophrenia, the cohort sizes are, you know, around 10,000 to 30,000. However, if you look at what's identified as significant, that's the last column there, we have so few lead genomic variants to go after. So this issue, you know, is going to be there for a while. The other thing is, the other issue that I am most interested in is that, okay, you get a significant genome-wide variant SNP. So then the immediate question is, then what? Okay, so, okay, obviously it's going to be useful for prediction, and also if it is in a coding region, if it is, you know, coding a protein at the end of the day, that's a happy story because there's a pretty clear path to follow up the variant. So, you know, it's probably doing something nasty to the protein, and then, you know, things are going crazy. However, if it is not in a coding region, but it is still in close to a gene, maybe it's in the intron or immediate upstream of the gene, which has regulatory processes for the gene, then it's still okay. However, if it is in distal region, very far away from any gene in this gene desert, then it's actually a pretty sad story. So then if you take all the genome-wide variant SNPs in the NHGRI's DB SNP database, there are about 14,000 of them, and ask where are they in the genome, actually only less than 5% are in coding regions. Most of them are in intronic regions or in distal regions. Okay, so then the question is, what do they do? Today, through large consortia projects, we know that there's a lot of evidence that these variants might be disrupting epigenomic processes. So then, what are these processes? Just briefly, if you think about DNA wrapping around histone proteins, Yuan talked about histones, which was a really great introduction for me. So, you know, these proteins, DNA is wrapping around them, and there are a lot of regulatory processes that take place in this chromatin structure. Histone modifications, you know, the chemical modifications of these proteins is one of them. The way that these histones line up together so that to form the chromatin structure, that's also part of this regulatory process. There are DNA binding proteins called transcription factors. They recognize DNA in a sequence-specific manner. Those are also important. The way that, you know, whether or not part of the DNA is accessible by proteins, by regulatory proteins, that's also part of the epigenome, and so on. So all of these are complicated processes, but there are essentially four key points here. One of them is, you know, the way that genes are expressed are highly regulated by these processes. And good news is today we have high-throughput technologies to measure, to take genome-wide measurements of these events. Yeah? And there's a lot of evidence that sequence perturbations of these epigenomic events are related to various types of diseases, from cancer to Alzheimer's. And then, and perhaps most importantly, large projects like ENCODE, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, Roadmap Epigenome Mapping Consortium, RAMSI, and IHEC, International Human Epigenome Consortium, generated large amounts of data, okay, measuring all these various processes. Okay. So then the key is, how can we best utilize this data to learn more about our genetic variants and SNPs? So that's the question that we are after. So this is a, in a way, emerging area of statistical genomics. So there are a couple of approaches out there. One of them is just purely annotation. You give me a SNP, I figure out where it is, you know, and tell me the location. Then I can figure out whether it's in a histone-modified region, it's in a transcription factor binding region, and so on. Just, you know, giving you back the all the annotations, all the known information. Okay, the other class of approaches is that you have a set of SNPs, your significant SNPs, this is maybe 10 SNPs, 20 SNPs, and you want to know whether they overlap with, for example, DNA methylated regions more than expected by chance. Then you can say that these SNPs are, you know, enriched for DNA methylation in this particular cell type. So again, not too deep information, but it's telling you that maybe those SNPs are perturbing something about the methylation. And then the third class that's really up and coming is utilizing these epigenomic data to prioritize your SNPs. So I have 20 SNPs. I have their prioritization just based on association data, my case control study. So what else can I add to that information so that I maybe get a bit different ranking? So these all have other types of shortcomings, but I'll come back to that in a little bit. So I have a little side story here. So for all of these methods, one type of annotation that's simple to understand and doesn't require any genome-wide measurement is investigating whether or not that SNP might be perturbing a binding site. So for example, let's say we have a gene here. This is the immediate upstream of the gene, promoter region, where lots of these regulatory processes take place. And then let's say we have a SNP that changes G to A. So if we look at this region, it turns out that there is actually a NF-kappa-B binding site. So this is a protein. It binds here and then regulates this gene. And without the SNP, there's actually a pretty nice match to the type of sequences that this protein likes to bind to. Okay? However, with the SNP, you're essentially disrupting that binding site. Okay? So SNP essentially disrupts binding site. And so then, you know, protein may not be able to bind there. So this is one mechanism how these genomic variants can act. So then, so this is something, you know, given all the SNPs and the database of these binding sites, okay, again, if you aren't familiar with this, so this is the protein likes to recognize sequences of this length, and the heights of the letters are just telling you the preference of preferred nucleotides at that position. So, you know, for the second and third position, it has to be a G. For the first position, there's some degeneracy. It could be G or T. So that's the basic idea. I have a couple of those, so then I want to make sure you kind of know what these mean. So then, you know, given SNPs and this kind of information, we can calculate, you know, the likelihood of this sequence under this model, and then likelihood of this sequence under this model, and then, you know, evaluate whether or not SNP is causing a significant change in the score. Sounds simple enough. It is simple. These logos have been around for the last 20 years. However, if you want to do it for like 20,000 SNPs, there is no tool out there that can do it for you. Okay? So we first said, okay, let's essentially develop something. We kind of had to, so that we can evaluate for all of our SNPs what's their impact on large lists of transcription factor binding sites. So these methods, so what we developed start with, you know, a list of SNPs and a list of motifs or binding sites that you want to evaluate. Okay? And then you extract the sequence around the SNP, and then you consider all subsequences that overlap the SNP. Okay, so this one, et cetera. And then you find the best match to the motif with the reference allele and the SNP allele, and then you calculate the scores, you know, for the reference allele and the SNP allele, and then you evaluate whether the change you are seeing in the score is significant. Okay, so we have developed an R package, which is pretty easy to use, and I mean it, easy to use. It implements important sampling instead of naive Monte Carlo, so that we can generate lots of samples and evaluate, calculate sensitive p-values. And then instead of looking at actual score change, we are actually quantifying the effect size a little bit differently, and we are looking at the change in p-values, which roughly corresponds to the change in ranks. So I won't go into the details, but I'll emphasize, so whatever is out there, you know, none of them can actually beat EdSNP in terms of scalability or visualization. For visualization, the package automatically generates these type of plots that we call composite logo plots. So at the top and the bottom, you have the position weight matrix, you know, representation of the sequence that the protein likes to bind to. And then in the second row, you have the genomic sequence with the reference allele and the genomic sequence with the SNP allele. And the SNP position is, you know, boxed a little bit. So in this region, this is the best match to the position weight matrix with the reference allele, best match to the position weight matrix or the motif with the SNP allele. So this is just what I call eyeball checking. So even if you get a p-value, you know, you want to look at, okay, do I really have a good match to the binding, to the binding site in that region? For example, you know, if we had a significant p-value, but this position wasn't a C or this position wasn't a G, so I would be less confident in this prediction. So I'll skip this perhaps for the... Okay, so now that we have this tool, so we can generate these kind of annotations for all of our SNPs. I want to go back to the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium data and look at these psychiatric diseases. So I mentioned that there are already a number of emerging methods for integrating GWAS results with the epigenomic data. Some of the shortcomings, without getting into too much detail, are that, you know, some of them are actually just for fine mapping. So that means you already get your set of significant SNPs, but most of them are going to be in high linkage disequilibrium, so you want to discriminate between them. So some of these methods are getting good at doing that. And a key point here is that, so these annotations, so, you know, scores, you know, whether or not a SNP is affecting transcription factor binding, those one type of annotation, whether or not the SNP is in a histone-modified region, in a methylated region. So these are all different type of functional annotations. But most of these are coming from high-throughput measurements, and there is noise in there. And also, often what could happen is that, you know, your disease, the cell types that these processes are measured might have nothing to do with your disease etiology. So then you actually need something that can kind of choose between different annotations. So the currently available methods are kind of agnostic to this. They'll use all of the annotations. And also another major shortcoming that I'll try to make clear in a little bit is that they assume global models for the SNPs. It means that they expect that the SNPs associate with the annotations in a particular way, and all the SNPs do that, which is definitely not true. So just to set the stage in terms of how we are viewing the data, so we have association measures for all the SNPs. So you analyze your GWAS, you know, maybe you calculated log-odds ratios, you know, one SNP, one phenotype at a time. So that's one of these Y columns. And then we could be looking at multiple diseases simultaneously. And the X is for each SNP, you have its annotation. Yes, it's in a... you know, GATA binding site. Yes, it is modified. It's in a H3K27 acetylation modified site, and so on. So this is the list of annotations that's coming from these databases like RMC, ENCODE, and IHAC. Okay. And for the sake of this presentation, I'm actually sticking to affinity change on transcription factors, whether or not the SNP might be affecting binding of a transcription factor. And there are transcription factor databases that we are able to utilize for that. So the first thing that we did was to explore the associations between genome-wide association measures and the functional annotations. So for each disease, I have the set of association measures for my GWAS. And then for I also have, you know, large numbers of vectors of annotations. So I'm just looking at their correlation and then maybe calculating p-value and then doing a heat map. So here, the rows are different annotation, functional annotations, and each entry represents how well that functional annotation correlates with the GWAS association measure. So we can see that there's a lot of clustering, so same set of functional annotations correlate similarly across different diseases. And however, if you adjust this for multiple testing, any sort of multiple testing, pretty much you only have some associations retained for bipolar disease and major depressive disorder. For others, you don't get anything significant. Okay. So at the core, what we are trying to do is that when you are doing a GWAS study, so you are looking at both odds ratio. You know, SNP increases risk, SNP decreases risk. So what we want to do is bring in other dimensions, okay, so that we can improve power. Maybe, okay, so when we are looking at this dimension, you know, we make our cutoffs, you know, genome-wide significant cutoffs, and then we'll have this guy and this guy as significantly associated with the phenotype, with the disease risk. However, when we bring in another dimension, now maybe we can say that, well, you know, these two, that they don't quite make the cutoff, but they have they are, you know, following the general trend of the association between genome-wide association measure and the functional annotation, so maybe these are worth looking at, and then similarly here. So that really is the basic idea. So try to bring in additional information so that we can improve the power. And it's not just improving power, because whatever we put here, these are pretty specific epigenomic events. So then we can hypothesize what actually might be happening. So in this case, you know, if we have here effect on transcription factor binding affinity, then for this SNP we'll be able to say that, okay, this is, you know, actually changing the transcription factor binding, so that gives us a testable hypothesis. Okay. But then, of course, this is simulated data. If you look at the real data, it looks more like this. So it's not the end of the story, because if you think about all these complex diseases, you know, wishing something like this, I mean, this you shouldn't even be seeing in your dream, because this is way too optimistic. Because all these complex diseases, even if they are disrupting the same pathway, there are so many different epigenomic events that contribute to that pathway. So unless you design like super covariates that kind of combines all these informations between, you know, across different epigenomic events, you can never see something like this. And we have examples of this where, you know, you find SNPs in the coding regions, in the non-coding regions, in transcription factor binding sites. So the real story is probably more like this. There are, you know, a group of SNPs whose association measure correlates similarly with a subset of the annotations. So this is really, you know, we look at this cloud, but this is really the kind of signal we are trying to dig out. Okay. So for this, we developed something called annotation regression for genome-wide association studies. Essentially, it boils down to a finite mixture model of regressions. The way that we are viewing the data is now, there are, you know, we are looking for these groups of SNPs who associate with the functional annotations in the same way. So this is the mathematical formulation. And for this, mixture of regressions is a topic that's studied in statistics literature. However, not with so much with high dimensional data. So you want to, you know, kind of cluster the SNPs, but simultaneously also select the variables that contribute to each SNP. So there's a package developed by Peter Bulman and Sarah Van de Geer. So we are right now using it. But we are also adding on top of it, once we identify our clusters and have an initial variable selection, we actually have to do another level of lasso-type penalized regression to get rid of false positives. And then on top of it, since these, you know, we are working in a setting very lower signal-to-noise ratio, we also do permutation approaches to validate that, you know, any effect size that we are seeing is actually not by chance. So I have an application of it. I don't want to go into the details of how we selected the SNPs, but the basic idea is now instead of focusing on your top SNPs, you can be more liberal, maybe do FDR control. So in this particular example, we have a little bit more than 2,000 SNPs. When we apply this for many things, but I'm presenting the autism story here. For autism, we get three clusters, and one of the clusters have FOXL1 binding. One of the clusters indicates that association measures of the SNPs correlate with FOXL1 binding, their effect on FOXL1 binding, and on NKX25 binding. So this is all the data, and these are the red are the data points in these three clusters. Again, you know, this is the setting where you can say, oh, is that an outlier? I mean, we are looking for these kind of outliers. So we then do whole permutation tests where we permute the GWAS association measures but don't permute the function annotations because we want to keep the correlations among them intact. So we can verify that, you know, this kind of effect size, actually, you can't be seeing it due to chance. So then now we can look at all of these SNPs. If you look at this one, it turns out that this is in the genome, there's a G. The SNP is changing G to an A. And by doing that, it's actually generating a binding site for this transcription factor FOXL1. And I had here association p-value. So this is the p-value you get from your GWAS without using anything else. So this is something that you definitely wouldn't be looking at. Because, you know, GWAS significance cutoffs, that's 5, 10 times to the power minus 8, you know, along that range. Okay. So then, okay, the great thing is now these data sets, these databases have additional information, then we can go back and see. For example, if we take this SNP, look where it is on the genome, it's here. This is a browser shot from University of Washington's Epigenome browser. And then dark colors here mean that there is signal there. So we can see that this SNP falls into a region where there is epigenomic activity in the brain samples, in the brain cells. So that's good. Okay. And then it turns out that this is actually in the intron of a gene called TCF4. And TCF4 turns out to be a very highly expressed gene in brain. So far, it's, you know, the little pieces are making sense, and FOXL1 is actually itself a repressor. So what could be happening is that this SNP is generating a binding site for FOXL1, and then maybe FOXL1 is binding there, and then repressing TCF4, where in fact it should be expressed. Okay, so that's a big story. We are now working on experimentally following this up, but the point I want to make is that, you know, if we didn't bring in this additional information, nobody would have looked at this SNP. Then we have done, do I still have time? Okay. So then we have done simulations. Again, this low signal-to-noise setting, we want to make sure that, you know, the kind of results that we are pulling up are not due to by chance. So, you know, we have done these data-driven simulations where we keep the signal-to-noise similar to the signal-to-noise we are seeing in the real data. And then looked at what the results look like. So as methods, we put in lasso. You take all of your GWAS SNPs and that X matrix, and then you just do lasso on them. Or you even want to do, you know, multiple linear regression, but then, you know, threshold your p-values with FDR or something else. Okay. And then two versions of annotation regression, AROG, just using finite mixture model and finite mixture model with another added level of cluster level lasso. So we were able to see that this second layer is actually useful for reducing the false positives. And an interesting thing was that if you evaluated the ROC curves for these different methods, so ROC curve for AROG1 and AROG2, these would be as a function of the tuning parameters. So then you didn't really see difference between them in the range that you would care. So what could be happening is that, you know, when you are choosing these tuning parameters with finite data, maybe it's just a hard problem, and then that's why the second level of lasso might be helping. Okay, so now we have, so this was our, you know, initial attempt at this problem. We are working on multiple things. One of them is incorporating better transcription factor binding site models. And right now, the SNPs, so we assume that the SNPs are independent, which obviously they are not. You know, there's a lot of linkage disequilibrium. So we want to incorporate more structured covariance matrices in these clusters. And right now, we only looked at one disease at a time. So obviously, we want to do this for multiple diseases. And then we started with the simplest annotation possible. And so now we want to include other type of annotations. So with that, I want to thank my collaborators and students. So this at SNP was mostly work of my PhD student, Chandler, and AROG is mostly my work, mostly work of my postdoc, Sunyong, and we have been collaborating with a colleague from the Department of Psychiatry. And if, you know, if you just type Sundus Keresh, so you'll, it will take you to wonderful places. One of them is our GitHub, where our most of our software is hosted. So at SNP is easily accessible there. And with that, I want to thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Right. So that's a great question. And so for that, we actually have a very specific annotation that we are designing, because the SNP, when these transcription factor binds, you know, they often have cofactors on, or, you know, they might bind when the GC content or some local sequence content has specific characteristics. So when you are evaluating a SNP's contribution to a binding site, you actually don't want to just do it for the binding site itself, but you want to get a composite measure of the surroundings. And there are these in vitro assays put in binding microarrays. Now they have sequencing versions of that. So with those, you can measure the impact of every nucleotide change for transcription factor binding. So we are aggregating data from those type of experiments to come up with better representation of these annotations that reflect, you know, how the SNP might be affecting transcription factor binding. That's, we haven't done it, but those are available, so you could, so this framework would take in those kind of scores. But what we are really after is that not so much, if you are just doing prioritization, you know, evolution score, everything would be very useful, but we also want something that can tell us, you know, what might be the mechanism, you know. So is it something about the DNA's accessibility, histone modification, transcription factor binding, and so on. So we want to, you know, like kind of open up that black box and generate these little cute hypotheses for the PIs to follow up.
Let's thank our speaker again.